Good day and welcome to Observations. On this program, we're going to do something we haven't done in a while. We're going to have a co-host actually lead this discussion. Kirk, who has contributed to the Shattering Myth shows and to the initial Observations program, is prepared to share with us what he has learned about the transition that occurred in America. This place in time where America became the merchant of death, the world's premier manufacturer of weapons of all kinds, and the world's largest military, as well as implementing the world's most elaborate spy apparatus, as well as developing the world's largest prison population. America became the very things that it said that it detested. When did that occur? How did that occur? Now, Observations is a program that is devoted to understanding Yahweh's testimony and how it applies to our lives. But as Kirk will share, Yahweh has a lot to say about human governance. The most elaborate discussion is found in the first book of Samuel. Listen to him, Samuel, beginning in the 8th chapter, where the children of Israel want to have a king like other Gentile nations. And Yahweh's response to this is amazing. It's insightful, profound. And it's amazing that it's so seldom discussed. I think it's so seldom discussed mainly because it is so contrary to most things that we humans have been led to believe. So, Kirk, the program is yours. I'm looking forward to listening to what you have discovered.
Okay. Well, I'm going to leave this Samuel section for a minute until mm-hmm. we just get into the program a little bit. Mm-hmm. What prompted me to do some extra research, I like history, and mm-hmm. I run across some things that connected some dots that I had not considered in the past, or I couldn't prove certain things had happened, pardon me. And I was thinking with the backdrop of the prophecies regarding pestilence, and then also with the next two world wars. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to see if there's anything I could gain from studying World War One and World War Two. And the deeper I got into it, and nowadays with the use of a computer, which I'm not good at, but I'm getting a little bit better, I can research in so many different directions, and I can usually find a right or wrong answer to the things that I was exposing. Either this happened or it didn't happen. There's enough proof to believe it or enough to reject it.
Yeah, for example, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there. And when I read things or send things that appear in secondary periodicals or online sources, blogs, the first thing you do is if it's written in such a way that it says, oh, that's no way. I'll usually just discount it out of hand. But if it is appears like it's credible, then what you have to do is verify whether or not the information that the person is basing their claim on is true. And it takes some time. But some of the most unbelievable, some of the most outrageous things are actually true.
Right.
And it really paints a horrible picture. It's really why I went from being a active person in politics and a patriot to being anti-political and anti-patriotic. It's the investigation on these kinds of things. So with that in mind, I'm with you. This is something that's important. In fact, Larry, I think, is an individual who has chased down a lot of these rumors as to whether or not they hold water, whether or not they true. So you were confronted with some things that seemed amazing.
They were. And
indicting.
I'm not a conspiracy person in the sense that there's a bunch of people behind the scenes trying to hide everything. In fact, everything is pretty much out in the open. All you have to do is connect the dots. And there's nothing that I'll say today that you couldn't find and prove it for yourself. But the things were so sickening to me especially when you confine it to just pestilence and germ warfare, that it was. I don't know how people can think this way. It has to be a satanic thing that gets into you to do so. But I wanted to talk about World War One, but in order to get into World War One for the listeners, I know you know a lot about this, and I know probably Larry knows a lot about this, but I was going to paint a very quick picture of the decaying empires of Europe that led up to World War One, and what some of their ambitions were and what motivated people to start that war, and then for us to how we could get it, how, why and how we got into it. And just briefly, and throw in anything you want as I go along the way, but you have...
And by the way, keep in mind that the story of World War One, while the story tells us that tens of millions of people were killed, the real story of World War One isn't the horror of what was the most demonic battlefield, probably in human history. The real story and the cost of World War One is the epidemic that's called the Spanish flu, that was neither Spanish nor flu, that killed 40 to 50 million people worldwide.
I have bigger numbers that we're probably right, and some of them are government numbers. They've held those off, but we'll set the stage on who the players were, and then I'll get you into how we got there and why America jumped in, and quite a discussion about our president at the time, Woodrow Wilson. But for those of you who are not that familiar on history, is in Europe you have, of course, a fading empire in England, Victoria as the queen, leading up that. And, of course, they're holding on for dear life with India and certainly the ports of China. And they are financially broke. A little aside to that is you might not know, most people are kind of stunned by this. The English were drinking a lot of tea and importing it. Their balance of payments were terrible. And they had to pay so much money, and this was real money in the old days. You had to pay in silver and gold. And they started opium. They started bringing opium in from India into China to equalize the balance of payments. So they're having all kind of mess. They're terribly immoral, as we know. They were killing people everywhere they went. And I grew up in Australia, and all you have to do is just do a little research. This is an immoral empire that's collapsing.
You've got the East Indian Trading Company, correct?
Well, they dominated the whole of India and Pakistan. They got Burma. And that was the last, as their empires collapsed, as we broke away, and most of the Commonwealth nations that were part of the empire, they broke away to some degree with certain agreements. We have an empire that cannot be stretched this far because it's built on raw goods for pennies that they can sell for thousands.
Yeah, you know what's amazing, too, is that most Americans view Great Britain very favorably, and we view them as our ally. But... in the area of God, since that is the focus of this program, there is no country on earth that at least over the last 100 years has been as disastrous to the lives of the chosen people as Great Britain. While Germany was the hammer, and Germany brought us the concentration camps, the death camps, it was actually Great Britain's malfeasance that made them possible. And the mess that we see in the Middle East today, that is the vice that is designed to crush Israel, is of Great Britain's creation.
I'll prove it to you later.
Okay, so this is, it's no small potatoes when we're talking about Great Britain. And Larry, you've spent some time in conspiratorial circles. There is a general feeling that Great Britain still wags America's tail, that they are...
I believe they are the dog.
Actually. Yeah, they're the dog and we're the tail. Yeah. We're their tool.
Well, I mean, you did some extensive work about the creature from Jekyll Island, and it was exactly 10 years after that, or maybe a little more. It was in 1928 that that MI5 came over and helped set up the CFR and buy all the newspapers, and they have controlled American political landscape ever since.
Yeah, it's amazing that America's newspapers the transition to independence to a collective in America's newspapers and media all began as a part of Woodrow Wilson's scheme to deceive Americans to justify lying on his campaign promises and to drag America into war that it had no business being in. But the American newspapers and media became a conglomerate, if you will, to make it possible for Woodrow Wilson and company, and Great Britain, because it was also Churchill that was involved in this, to have the Lusitania sunk deliberately to justify American troops going into
war. It was loaded with munitions.
Right, and and the newspapers were all given money from Germany to run ads to tell what was going to occur and why it was being used this way before it even set sail, and to keep those newspapers from running those advertisements and those editorials, America saw to it that they were purchased and became a collective. And so this is an enormous part of the transition here. So go ahead, Kirk. So you're setting the stage. What were the conditions in Europe?
Well, the conditions in Europe, so first of all, you've also got France is losing their grip on everything. They still have Algeria and they still have Indochina, but that's about the extent of their empire. Russia, as we know about at the turn of the 1900s and the early 1900s, is falling apart financially, primarily because Nicholas has spent all the money. They've lived lavishly and they're very poor.
Right. And it was this war that ultimately brought them down, because and it was in the midst of this war, the Bolshevik revolution took place, where the Tsar and his family were murdered by socialists who were living in and advancing their cause in all places in America.
Right. And you know, by the way, just for the uninitiated, Nicholas was the cousin to Victoria,
mm-hmm.
and as was Wilhelm, or Willie, cousin Willie, the Kaiser of Germany,
mm-hmm.
as was, Nicholas being the Tsar. And the Tsar and Kaiser are the roots of Caesar, by the
yes.
way.
Yes, yeah, and they all were an amalgamation of cleric
right.
and king. This was the Roman Catholic Church, either as the Russian Orthodox Church, which grew out of the Eastern Russian or the Eastern Roman Church, or variations of it, and they were they had all imposed their legitimacy based upon an amalgamation, an integration of religion and politics. These were all related scumbags.
Aren't really Windsors, they're Gauls, they're Germans, you know, for
mm-hmm.
one thing.
So you've got also another big factor, two other big factors. I won't worry too much about the Ottoman Empire or Italy as small potatoes. And Ottoman is just broke. As I remember, you sent us a book. You had a guest one time, and that was quite insightful on how they were in the throes of inflation because they had also spent all the money.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a broke empire for all practical purposes. But the two that are most...
And by the way, so with the common denominator of every one of these countries
mm-hmm.
is they're broke.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the lead-up to World War I, which began in 1917, ended in the fall of 1918. What happened around the world just 4 years prior to that? Larry, do you know what happened in 1913?
There was a depression.
Well, yes, but what happened in America that is profound that would lead directly to the world having gone broke because they overspent? What happened in America?
That was Social Security implemented.
Nope. 1913. Woodrow Wilson and Colonel House met on with sent. Their team to Jekyll Island, by the way, with a few Brits.
Right. Yeah, and then right after that, Woodrow Wilson instituted the Social Security.
Well, he implemented two things. One is the The Federal Reserve was created in 1913, which is a central bank, and then the federal income tax in 19.
Federal Reserve. That
so he had the means to rob Americans of their wealth, and he had the means for the first time to create fiat money. And America did not act alone. Jekyll Island was not simply an American undertaking. It happened also with other countries in Europe, and the world made the migration to fiat money and central banks in 1913. And so by 1917, all of those countries that had done so were broke. Why? Because the politicians, the clerics and kings, could spend the next leader's money. They could indebt their country and try to create spending that would create the illusion of prosperity. And they could also borrow money to go to war. So I think that the single most important act in creating the environment for World War I is the creation of central banks like the Federal Reserve in 1913 in the United States of America, and then the imposition of a national confiscation scheme called the federal income tax. Those two things occurred at that time.
The way they set that up, the way they set up.
3 years. Wow. 3 years, the world.
People wearing costumes, getting on trains anonymously.
Within 4 or 5 years, 100 million people would die.
Or more.
Okay, go ahead.
We got two other players that we need to just throw mm-hmm. out the table so everybody can see the picture. You've got, which is quite important, you have the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Austrian Empire was collapsing as well. And if you, in my era, that was the southern part of the Hungarian Empire was most of Yugoslavia, where you have Serbs and Croatians and all these different makeups from Roman Catholics to Greek Orthodox to Muslims to on and on and on and on. So you've got this really hard to keep together group. But for some reason, the Austrians were very good at putting that together for quite a while. But it's kaput now at this stage of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Germany, which is under Wilhelm.
Mm-hmm.
And Cousin Willie, he's got a plan to break them out. You have to remember that Germany has cold weather ports and no energy. Now, the whole world has changed since the Industrial Revolution because you have now everything is run on metals and everything is run on gas and oil. You mm-hmm. can have a steam shovel or you can have a gas-fired furnace or a coal furnace. They have coal, but they don't have oil, and you need oil if you're going to build a big navy.
Right.
So that's changes. That's just technological changes that have happened. So, but you still got to have a port. Now, it's the same thing that affects Russia today. It's the same thing that would affect Germany today. The goal of Willie, and this terrorized everything I read, this kind of terrorized everyone in England and France, because his goal was to pick up the pieces, basically, of Austria-Hungarian Empire and take it all the way down to the Middle East where he could get the oil. You know Hitler tried to do the same thing.
Right.
We know Russia has been trying to do the same thing one way or the other through the period. So that scared the British Empire, certainly scared the French Empire to death, because if they get to the oil, then they are extraordinarily powerful. And now Germany's aligned with, just for a little backdrop, more backdrop information, Germany and the Austrian Empire are joined together. France, England, and to a degree, Russia.
Yeah, this is the ultimate, this is an absolute in-your-face conspiracy.
Yeah,
right? So what this is, we're not hiding it in any way here.
No.
This is worldwide conspiracy on behalf of cleric and king.
Right.
Yeah, not hidden. No, you don't even need to look at the Council on Foreign Relations. You don't need to look at the Round Table or the Bilderbergers. This is world conspiracy.
Truly,
open for the world to see. And the immediate consequence of this was not only world war, but world plague.
Yeah. Halal Ben Shikar will tell you right to your face.
Yes.
You know, that's the only comparable That's the only comparison I can draw. I mean,
right.
These people are satanic.
Yeah, this was right in your face, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's not like you got to go looking for it. All you got to do is study it.
Right. So if you want to look at what a world conspiracy would be like in terms of war and plague, you know, the great contributors to death, you don't have to look any further than the way the world set up in the between 1913 and 1918.
Mm-hmm. So now when you're reading your history books and you've got the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and you have that story of Duke Ferdinand,
mm-hmm.
Franz Ferdinand and his wife getting shot in 1914, that pretty much just allows Germany to say, okay, we have to protect all the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives them a chance to go down and do this, you know, do the dirty deed, invade.
Mm-hmm.
And that scares Russia. And that certainly scares France and England, because now they know what they, and if they didn't know before, they certainly know what they're doing now. Now, consider something for just a minute is if Germany goes down through here, Russia has to live up to the agreement with France and England. They have to attack. They don't have any money.
Right.
France is pretty much broke, too. The English pound sterling is based on paper money now. Because they can't afford to use real money, they'd go broke real, very, very, very quick, and they do even then.
But with fiat money, do you know of a nation with fiat money that with a central bank that went that solved at least by appearances the fact that they were in a Great Depression by going to war?
Oh, Germany.
And how about the United States?
Well, the United States, we went into greenbacks and the Civil War.
Yeah, we did it. Yeah, we did in the Civil War, but we also did it for World War II. That's the thing.
And we probably financed the Spanish-American War with it as well. I don't know, but verbatim, but regardless, that's what you have to do. You got to pay the troops. You know,
right.
You know, there's a
and you got to buy the weapons.
Yeah. Well, now, yeah, that in too. But interesting little fact: a lot of people don't seem to know there's, you know, the difference between a commissioned officer and a non-commissioned officer in the Army.
No. Why do they use commission and non-commission
well,
as the terms?
Officer,
but I know that you're dealing with officers and enlisted.
No,
is the, but go ahead.
It's not quite that simple. Is the non-commissioned officers can be a rank of a major, the same equivalent. However, these are the groups of soldiers that their only contract is, as long as you pay me, I have to do what you tell me.
Hmm.
If you're a commissioned officer, you have to go to war whether they pay you or not. You are part of the club. You have a percentage of the take. That's the way it was set up.
Hmm. You have a commission.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, commission would be a percentage of the take.
Right.
That's an interesting observation.
It's a little take on these things. And if you see the look, if you were to study the Spanish-American War and the byproduct
commission.
Of that.
Commission is an economic term, right.
Oh, yeah. They not only did they get the economics, they got basically slaves to work for them, the Filipinos, and the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
It was very much like the British Empire in India. So, well, that was that. But that's a little aside. We'll go back to the big war, because I know it's a lot of material. And
okay.
I don't want to get everybody.
That term commissioned officer, though, I don't doubt that at some level, maybe in the senior officer's corps, you know, from lieutenant colonel up or something like that, there might be some commission. But I don't believe there is for your typical lieutenant captain. So,
no, it
was an old British system that we adapted, apparently, from everything.
Okay, they're calling it commission, there is a difference, too, in the oath. You take an oath to the president as an officer, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's pretty interesting. Yeah, an oath to the president.
Oath to the president.
Yeah, kind of to a man, as the commander-in-chief. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. So basically, we're back to the wars. They're living up to their agreements. Germany's invading.
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting on two fronts with the French and the English, and they're fighting the Russians. Now, the interesting thing that's overlooked a lot is that Germany, in about the first year of the World War One, destroys most of Russia on what they call there, which would be Western Russia, Eastern Front to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They capture everything. If you really want the best way to describe it, is probably from Poland, Estonia, all the way down to the Ukraine and down to most of Yugoslavia. and that is represents about 50% of all the wealth, the people, the industrial strength of Tsarist Russia. And that's the point when Lenin is allowed to go through Germany. Germany really is the one that supports him the most. They send him over there and support him to take over and keep them busy fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Which ultimately he will, the Socialist Party over, it will start a Socialist Party over there.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes Russia out of the equation for the rest of the war because they just don't have any money.
Correct. You know, yeah, the first thing that Lenin did is sign an armistice with the Germans.
Yes,
so they opted out. And by the way, the first American troops in World War I did not go to the battlefields of France. They went to Russia, where they were positioned on behalf of Lenin and company, the communists.
Aren't we special?
Oh, we are special.
Another interesting point there is that they wanted to make it look like the Jews invented socialism or communism.
Yeah.
And that was not true. That was invented off an island by the Jesuits. But when they marched out the Bolshevik Revolution, what they did was they had a bunch of guys dressed as Jewish guys with Yiddish signs. I mean, they were so beloved that... you know, when Stalin came in, he was the great Jew hater. Incredible.
Yeah.
Blame the Jews. You know, it's there's a theme throughout the world on that.
Yeah, the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a complete fraud. You know, it was actually a French novel where it was so thin and the perpetrators were so lame that they simply changed the title and changed the name of the characters, but left the rest of the story intact. It was more prevalent in communist Russia than it was even in Nazi Germany. So.
Yeah. So, well, in any case, now you've got a stalemate on the Eastern Front. You've got all kind of stuff going on the Western Front, and
right.
and the Germans moving towards the ultimate goal of making it to the Middle East. Now, if the stalemate was so bad, I think personally, and I'm just my comment, if I would think personally that if they'd left it alone and we had not entered, they would have settled up with a treaty. Most things end with a treaty.
Oh yeah, because we had England, which was providing, because you know Germany could not occupy England and was occupying much of France. That Germany or England was the place where the war materials were supplied on behalf of the Allied nations, and Germany had no credit. So so America was the source of Germany's credit, and it was strictly based upon the fact that the Germans came so close to prevailing, and that England was going to welch on all of the loans that had been made on by American banks, and through the purchase, America is supposed to be neutral, but they're purchasing American weapons. That to a large degree, maybe to the largest degree, America entered the war to save the American banks.
Yeah. Well, I think it's more complicated than that, but that's certainly one of the motives. That's how you get everybody on your side.
It's a well-known fact, and I know you're getting the whole sinking of the Lusitania joke. I mean,
well,
it was
people on board. You know, you got to have that with the news, so people will actually
because you want to rile up patriotism, so that people think that they're doing a service to God and country by making a sacrifice and going over and fighting the bad guys. You know, that's why Woodrow Wilson created at this time a propaganda council, the first time America had ever had one. And the purpose of the propaganda council was to draw Germans as this bloodthirsty monsters and to create this imagery of God and country for America that was the shining light that would go and thwart the bloodthirsty monster. And
oh,
he created
the
propaganda industry to do that.
There was only one president in history that ever had a PhD. Guess who that was?
Oh, yeah. Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
From
he was
from
a
Princeton.
Christian too.
Yeah, so. He was also a racist.
Yeah, sure.
Well, most of these guys are very racist.
Yeah, they're racist. Yeah, Woodrow Wilson is such a racist now that his images, his statues are being obliterated from Princeton as we speak.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm going to tell you a better reason, because now I'm going to show you the story behind the Spanish influenza.
Okay.
President Woodrow Wilson had a dream. And it's the first time I can find something where it was called the New World Order. That's the terms he actually used, or his organization used to peddle it.
It was kind of his 14-point plan that he came up with at this point, articulating there'll be no imperialism, and then America becomes the leading imperialist in the world.
Exactly. Yeah, here we have some music.
We will be back in a moment, and we will continue with observations.